We have a relatively short agenda, but of course that can be extended by much discussion if it's necessary. But the first bill up is with Senator Gimsey, House File 1585. I believe we have a quorum present, so they may not all be in their seats.
Yeah.
So Senator Thompson, what happened to him?
He just moved down.
He's in the room, yep.
Okay. Senator Gimsey?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Before you today, House File 1585, and House File 1585 was originally started out as an issue in my district, in which one of my school districts had some trouble getting placed in a conference because of an extended time frame of 180 days. And the language, as you see in House File 1585, is came out of the issue that surrounded that, and what we're trying to do is reduce the number of days that a school needs to make a good faith effort before being or asking the league to actually put them in a conference. So I have Roger Arnson with the Minnesota State High School League here to discuss some of the history and a little more on why this bill is before you.
Okay. Mr. Arnson.
Madam Chair, members, Roger Arnson with Minnesota State High School League. We appreciate Senator Gimsey bringing this bill forward. As he indicated, this was a local bill initially. This is an old statute. It's over 30 years old. When some of the private school Catholic basketball leagues were closed years ago, those schools had trouble finding conferences. The legislature passed the statute that is codified at 128C07. That says the league will make conference placements provided certain things happen. And one of the things the districts had to do, or the schools had to do, was search for a new conference for 180 days. That time period is no longer necessary to be that long. And it did pose some problems for all the Melrose. And we worked those out, but we thought this was a good opportunity to change the statute as well. And we don't know of any opposition to this at all, and we think this will help us do this.
Okay. Any members? Is there anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Not committee members, any questions of Mr. Arnson or the Senator Gimsey? Senator Stubb.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question as to what do you think was the rationale for the 180 days?
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, I think that might have been a communication piece in dealing with conferences at the time. 30 years ago, it was a little different, I think, organizing people, you know, as to going to those meetings and that sort of thing. I think. Now, there have been some high-profile public pieces as well with some other districts that we can see that it doesn't work, but I think that's what that was. Other than that, we really can't think of anything. And Senator, you think about making people sit a half of a calendar year while they did this seemed an extraordinarily long time.
Thank you.
Is there any further discussion or questions? Would somebody like to move House File 1585?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm happy to. I was going to ask the author if he thought this was a nominee for consent calendar.
Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, I think so. I don't know of any other committees that have requested the bill. So,
I mean, I think all of us are with the idea of something to get done sooner rather than later. Yeah. That's better. Yep. So that we can agree. Okay.
So move that be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar.
All right. It's been moved by Senator Uyghur that House File 1585 be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Same sign. The motion prevails.
Thank you.
It's passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
The next bill is Senator Niehaus, Senate File 1165.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1165. Before we start, I guess, Madam Chair, I just would offer an author's amendment. There's an A3 amendment. Is that in the packets?
I believe it is.
It's an A1.
There's an A1, so there must be an A. If it's not A1, it's.
We're going to hand it out.
Well,
okay.
Madam Chair, I believe the A3 amendment.
All right, it's coming.
Oh, is it coming?
It's coming.
Okay. What I was going to say is I think the A3 amendment is only the second half of the A1.
All right. So this is an author's amendment to get the shape. The bill, this is the first hearing of this bill, I presume?
Yes, Madam Chair.
So, all in favor of the author's amendment, the A3 amendment to Senate File 1165, signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1165 relates to interagency early intervention committees. This bill would essentially broaden the scope of those, and we're talking very young children. Would essentially broaden the scope of those who are to be referred. Current law requires this for a substantiated case of abuse or neglect. This change would simply take that back a bit of maybe a step or a half step and include those that are also the subject of a maltreatment report. And it's important to note, members, that doesn't mean someone picked up the phone and called in a report. That means it's gone through a vetting process and it has been filtered, et cetera. That really is the very short version of what this bill does. And to get down into the nitty-gritty details, Madam Chair, I think it would be best just to let the proponents come and testify to that.
There are a number of this Alexander.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Introduce yourself for the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Alexander Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Thank you for letting us be here today, and thank you, too, to Senator Nino for bringing this important issue forward. As Senator Nino said, this bill, what it does is it updates the IEIC statute to make certain that children who are reported for abuse or neglect, infants and toddlers specifically under the age of 3, that they would be eligible for referral for the early intervention service piece through the IEIC. And that being said, just want to make certain that we're really focusing on intervening as early as possible and really focusing on the needs of children at their youngest ages. So that being said, I think I will move on here.
We have some more testifiers, Madam Chair, if you want to.
Okay.
I don't have the list in front of me who's up next. Okay.
Introduce
Madam Chairperson and Senators, I'm Michelle Fallon. I am a clinical social worker, practitioner, consultant, and trainer in a variety of very young children in settings, including therapeutic classroom. I've worked with home visiting programs, a number of and childcare, a lot of consultation in childcare. I was asked to speak today a little bit about the effects of what we call toxic stress on the developing brain that is the rationale for referring children at this very young age. As I believe Megan Gunner has testified for some of you, she is one of the world-renowned researchers at the University of Minnesota on this topic. My primer on this topic is that the brain, as you may know, is the only organ of the body that is not fully developed at birth. In fact, what we know now and what I wish I knew when I had teenagers in my house is that the brain is not fully developed until we're in our mid-20s. That said, it is the first years of life that the brain is developing most rapidly. While the neurons, the brain cells, our genetic potential is in place by the second trimester of pregnancy, the synapses or the connections between the cells are not in place till we're in our mid-20s. And God willing, we continue to develop new ones and learn till we die. But that said, but in the first 3 years, those synapses are wiring at about 700 per second based on experience. And that's related to simple biology. Our brain is trying to become as efficient as possible to have to meet the needs we have in our particular environment. As a human species, we are completely dependent for a number of years so that it is within relationships that children develop, because without the proximity of a caregiver, a human infant cannot survive. So that said, it's regulation, the ability to regulate our arousal, our emotions, our behavior, our ability to attend. We are dependent on humans to do that for us. An infant cannot soothe him or herself. And so it is. If the brain is wiring at that with that rapid rate, having a caregiver available, the brain wires to begin to take over that regulatory capacity. In the circumstances where there are adverse circumstances, so that a child is experiencing neglect, abuse, parental mental illness, exposure to domestic violence, that the caregiver, him or herself, cannot regulate that infant. What happens is that the brain, our regulatory capacity, our fight or flight response is activated. And if the child doesn't experience the soothing, the developing brain actually stays at a level of arousal that keeps that fight or flight. So, for example, when I worked in preschool day treatment, most of the kids referred to us had a diagnosis of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which was a misdiagnosis. Those were children who had experienced trauma or toxic stress, so that their brains were literally wired at this higher level of arousal. What that looks like is a little boy named Michael in the classroom who, his second week, he was a three-year-old, been removed from his mother's care from a drug home where he had experienced neglect and abuse. And when I was in a gym, balls, bikes, everything around him, and I rubbed my eyes, this child who was on the other side of the room screamed, "Michelle, why are you crying?" Now, I was the least interesting thing in the room. And why would he assume that because I itched my eye that I was crying? Because this child's survival depended on knowing where the caregiver was and knowing what kind of a mood she was in. So this Michael's brain had literally wired at this higher level of arousal. Now, a child who has to be that hypervigilant because of survival is not in any position to be able to learn. And when the brain is stressed, including our adult brains, there are release of stress hormones, cortisol, adrenaline, and in the very, very young child, if there's not an adult relationship that can mitigate the stress on the child, the developing brain is bathed in these hormones, and that directly affects the part of our brain that has to do with learning and memory and ability to regulate our impulses, our executive functioning. And so when we know children have been referred for concerns about maltreatment, we can assume these are children who have experienced significant stress and adversity and that their actual developing brain has been affected. The good news is that developmental trajectory that becomes derailed because of the adverse experiences, we know what those children need to put them back on that healthy developmental trajectory. We have those programs in Minnesota. And so I think what we want to be able to do is to identify those children very early on and to get them the appropriate services they need so that we can get them back on that healthy trajectory that allows them to regulate and learn to the best of their ability. There's a handout you have that summarizes some of this, but the American Academy of Pediatrics has recently come out with a position on toxic stress and development and is recommending that these children receive services once they are identified as having these things happen. You may be familiar with some of the adverse childhood experience studies, the ACEs, that's getting a lot of talk in Minnesota. That also demonstrates clearly that it is adverse childhood experiences which have been found to be most highly correlated with adult disease, including heart disease, depression, diabetes. So from a physical health, mental health, and certainly from a learning and behavior standpoint, these early adverse experiences have a profound effect but can be remediated with early intervention, and the research on that is very, very clear. Questions?
Thank you.
Madam Chairman?
There are... was that a member that was asking? Are there any questions of our witness, Michelle Fallon?
Madam Chair?
Senator Wicker.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I'm not sure if this was covered, but how many young people do you feel are being unreported or should be included now in the proposal that we have?
Well, from my reading on it,
it
suggests that it would be children for whom there is a substantiated case of maltreatment.
But, Madam Chair, my question is, do you have an estimate of how many are we talking about?
Senator Nino.
I have some information that was supplied to me. In 2010, there were approximately 6,000 infants and toddlers reported for abuse and neglect. Approximately 2,000 of those went through the family investigation. In 2010, two-thirds of infants and toddlers who went through the family investigation were not included within the final requirement. So the information that was given to me was in the 3,000-4,000 range. However, someone representing the St. Paul Public Schools indicated maybe 2,500. So there's some varying numbers out there, but it's a relatively large number.
Yeah.
And my experience tells me that if a finding of maltreatment is made, that is the tip of the iceberg. And so we're talking about services for the most egregious forms of neglect and abuse. Not there in the ideal world, many, many other children would be recognized as such, but we're not talking about that right now.
Any further questions? Not. Thank you very much, Ms. Fallon.
Madam Chair, we also have Connie Skillingstad who would like to address the committee.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senators, it's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. I'm a social...
Will you say your name?
I'm sorry. Yes, I'm Connie Skillingstad. I am a social worker of 47 years here in Minnesota, and the most recent 10 years I was Director of Prevent Child Abuse Minnesota. During that 10 years working with Prevent Child Abuse, I learned a lot about the research that Michelle Fallon talked about. That research itself talks about the critical lifelong impact of early childhood maltreatment, of physical, sexual abuse, and emotional abuse, as well as severe neglect. Based on that research, we are all paying substantially for those long-term impacts. Our prison costs, foster care, delinquency, early pregnancy, relationship problems like domestic abuse, dating violence, future abuse of children as well as obesity, and long-term health care costs are all impacted by what happens in early childhood. I am also a survivor of a family in which violence was a part of our life. And the one thing and that's a long time ago, but the one thing that I truly regret was that there were no intervention. In our family, there was no one to help the family. And so my work in prevention has really come about as a result of my concern for that. What happens to those children affects every one of us and our own children. Okay, when you look at bullying in schools, or you look at things like the what feels like an increase in dating violence, those issues often relate to families where there has been violence of various kinds. It is essential that we work both to prevent abuse and neglect and to intervene as early as possible in order to minimize long-term problems. When I first started in social work down in Rock County, there was very little done in the area of child protection. And over the years, what I saw was that without substantiation, families virtually got no services. Over the past few years, there's been enormous work at reaching families once a child abuse report is made through the Family Assessment Program and through the Parent Support Outreach Program, both of which offer services to families on a voluntary basis. That means that we don't have to get into the adversarial relationship with parents that is extremely disruptive of families, that we can avoid the adversarial issues that make parents sort of the enemy by offering services earlier to families. As a result of that, we have seen some substantial changes in the ways that families are responding and in the success that we have with those families.
May I just ask a question?
Yes.
Are you saying that this, it means that they aren't turned over to child protection?
No, that's not what I mean at all. What happens, what has historically happened?
That's where you get into some adversarial relationships.
Right. The report would come to child protection. The issue is how it gets sorted out. And that is that if a family is offered services and they receive those services and the child is not in imminent danger, that means that the child protection worker and the parents can become partners in the work with their children, as opposed to a situation where we are moving down the road of removing children, placing them in foster care, and that type of thing. And we have found that there's success if we can reach families early, and we can get that support into those families. So once a report is made, that generally means, you know, unless someone is doing something specifically mean to somebody else, you know, that means that something is going on in that family. Okay, there is some basis for that report, and that families are needing help. And in turn, the opportunity then exists, which did not for many of my years as a social worker, the opportunity exists for a family to voluntarily get the help they need to parent their children. Now, if you were raised in a family like mine and did not get any support like I did, there is a high risk of you moving into another situation where you either get into a relationship with someone who's violent or you in turn may carry that into the next generation. And this way we can reach parents early and we can be supportive to them without making the parent the enemy. And believe me, keeping families together, knowing that kids grow up and say, I wish I could be with my family. I'm going to tell you a story. I was at St. Joseph's Home for Children in Minneapolis for 20 years. And I will never forget a teenage boy who at Christmas time I said, what would you like for Christmas? And he said, I want to go home. I want to be with my parents. And what we see over the, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little emotional, but what we see over the years is kids need their families. If we can get early support to those families, we can make a difference in terms of the outcomes for those kids. They will be more successful in school. And believe me, failure in school is a huge part of the life experience of kids coming out of families where there is abuse and neglect. So I really want to support
it. Question is, does current law either require or guide? Because, you know, you hear about the removal of children from the home, and I think you think of child protection, you know, if child protection gets involved, that's what's going to happen. How has that behavior changed that other services will be pursued versus removing them from the home?
Dave Thompson is here from DHS. I'm sure he could speak more eloquently about that than I can. But the bottom line is that as child protection workers, it is not the goal to remove children. It is the goal to have families strengthened and be able to be together. And so the vast majority of cases, that is not what happens. The child is not removed. We also, though, know statistically the kids in foster care who spend most of their life in foster care do not do very well. And so we want to put in the supports to a family that we can. But the earlier the better. The earlier that we can support children and their families, the less I think we'll see the long-term impacts, potential problems that are clearly there for those kids who don't get any help.
And Madam Chair, the proposal in front of us today certainly would not accelerate or expedite the process of those families that might get involved with protective services at a detailed level. Quite the contrary, what this is trying to do is you would need to have a substantiated case for protective services to get significantly involved in maybe removing the children, et cetera. This proposal is looking at scenarios where there is an unsubstantiated, but there is a report which indicates that something might be going on. In that circumstance, it would be offering up on a voluntary basis access to those services in the hopes to prevent a future substantiated case that maybe has been elevated and to the extent where protective services really does need to get involved. Mm-hmm. So the idea here is to be preventative.
So this is, this is in an education statute. I think you, part of your amendment is addressing a human services statute. So because it appears a lot of it is happening there, but this is particularly aimed at children with disabilities that have already been identified as children with disabilities.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I couldn't hear that.
I'm just saying that this is aimed, the current law appears to be that this is addressing here is that it's aimed at for children with disabilities under age 5 and their families.
Madam Chair, I believe we have an answer to my right.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcy Jeffries. I'm with the Children's Defense Fund. We have that language is in the amendment just to clarify for the child protection system that, in fact, these referrals should be made to the early intervention programs for these children who are in a reported case of a case that is screened in to child protection. So this does relate to the child maltreatment reporting statute,
which is in human services.
Right.
Okay, thank you. Okay. So, are there questions of Ms. Stillingstad? Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Nino, I guess I have a couple of quick questions I'm hoping you can help me with. You'll never find a bigger advocate for children than myself. I absolutely love children. I think everyone in this room does, otherwise you wouldn't have the desire to serve on an education committee. With that being said, I have some concerns with the legislation, and maybe you can walk me through these. I've seen times in the past where you start talking about substantiated abuse. There's a real big gray area there. So here's my concern. If I want my child to go to church twice a week, or let's say I don't give my children what we here at state government define as a reasonable amount of vegetables and fruits, and I know these are kind of a little bit out there, but we've seen things in the past that lead us to believe it's very possible to happen. I'm concerned about that gray area, so I'm hoping what you can do is maybe pin down what are the types of abuses that we're talking about here and maybe go into specific, you know, statute what this substantiated and unsubstantiated means, and maybe that'll help me be a little bit more comfortable here.
Senator Reno, or
well, Madam Chair, we can do that, but that really is outside the scope of what this bill is trying to get to. It's not affecting any substantiation. It's not setting a higher or lower bar. And quite frankly, it's not even addressing those situations at all. What it's addressing is a situation where there's presumably some sort of complaint or what have you, where whoever the recipient of that was vetted it, filtered it, decided that there was enough there to make a report. But in the end, it was not substantiated. The report was done, and there was nothing to say, yes, this really, really is a problem. there was just enough basically to take a look at it and write a report. In that event, what this legislation would do is say that in that circumstance, on a voluntary basis, the families would have access to the early intervention services.
Excuse me, but are there cell phones on? Because we've been told we could not have cell phones on in this room. It interferes with the system.
So to your concern, Senator, and I share some of the similar concerns. And you get gray areas, and can you get misuses or even abuses? And we can have that discussion. It's probably better for a different committee than this one, but it does not. This legislation does not get into that at all. What this legislation says, in those circumstances where there is a report, but the abuse is not really substantiated, if those families, if there's something going on where they think that these services would be helpful, they can avail themselves of that. I don't know if that helps, but.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on your question, because it was somewhat confusing as the relationship between the Department of Health and Human Services and the functionality of the Department of Education. Is there a fiscal note which hits the Department of Education for these services provided? And then beyond that question, I do want to thank you, Senator Nienau, for bringing it forward, because I'm a strong supporter of making the change. I think anything we can do to make intervention earlier and circumvent the consequences of not having done that is something we should do. But I am interested in how it affects the education budget.
Eric, can you address that?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff. There is not yet a fiscal note that is complete on this bill. That's the first answer to your question. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. Here, the request for the fiscal note was made on Friday, and it was done in the context of the original bill before the amendment. So now that the amendment's on, we'll need to have a conversation about that. But here's what I suspect will happen. I think that from the education side of things, there is a potential with this language that you will get students that would previously not have been identified to be identified as in need of special ed services. So logic would dictate, oh, that's going to generate more cost. So theoretically, there is an additional cost. However, under our current law, we have a capped appropriation for special education services. So what that would mean is a slightly higher level of proration, but not or slightly more proration, so the dollars would get spread out over more kids. That's what I suspect will happen, but I don't think that we're talking about large magnitude of dollars here. So the overall level of appropriation shouldn't change.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up question.
Senator Bonner.
We're talking about an age group that is before they hit kindergarten, and so that's, you know, in the early special ed category. Is that any different with – how does that affect the cap? Is that a different line item, or is that just
– Madam Chair, Senator Bonner, if you'll probably recall a few years ago that we rolled Part C into the overall special ed calculation.
Well, of course, Madam Chair, of course, Mr. Nelman, I recall that now. Thanks.
Okay. Senator Wolf, I think you were next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to piggyback a little bit on what Senator Bonhoff said. And I don't know if anybody is here from the county, but I spoke to the county on Friday just asking them about this bill, and I don't know if they understand the bill or not. But in their perception, this would they said give to the equivalent of they would need an extra staff person to handle the additional reports. So I know we're looking at it in the context of education, but I would also, I don't know if anybody from the county can address that, but they were saying at the county level that this would be a large increase for them and would probably result in them needing one extra staff person to handle the additional reports.
Senator, if we pass this bill out of here today, it would be referred to Health and Human Services Committee. I think they would need to look at that, and that would be their problem.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hand for morning.
Right. Madam Chair, I apologize. One thing I left out in the earlier discussion is that obviously I was talking about the state impact. It doesn't speak to a local
impact.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
So Yes, Senator Reno.
Just to that, I do know over in the other body, since last session, the author has been trying to get a local impact report, and that has not been forthcoming. So it's been attempted to be obtained, but I can't speak directly to the results of that. There may be a little bit of a misunderstanding at the county level in that we're not requiring them to do any more reports than they would right now, whether to substantiate or find out if it's unsubstantiated. They will already be doing that. But as a result of those reports that they're doing, we would be asking for them to do another some more referrals. And the numbers that I've been shown are somewhere statewide, you know, somewhere in that maybe 3,000 range. But that's not a complete report. That's literally a piece of paper and sending it over. But I can't speak directly to the results of the local impact report because it doesn't exist yet.
I think we'll probably have some people wanting to testify on that local impact here yet today. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to commend Ms. Fallon, who testified. You know, I think it's hard to understand exactly what happens to our early childhood children and some of the circumstances that they go through and why they probably have difficulty in many cases throughout their whole life. But I thought that description was very, very understandable and a good reason why I think early intervention is so important. And it, you know, you talk about maybe the cost, and there might be a cost, whether it's state or local. But when you look at the bonding committee, and a number of you are on the bonding committee, when we go to different facilities, such as St. Cloud Penitentiary, and you see all these young men going in there, backing up buses, literally, to unload these people, I think theoretically and maybe realistically, you could say if you could keep some of these people out of the system, you would have a big savings, or at least a savings, which, you know, I could never, you know, weigh the two, but I know it seems to me that it would be a lot more economical to help those young children early than it would be to pay for them as adults. And certainly I think for their families it would be a lot better too. Well, that was just a comment.
Yeah, Senator Stump, I share your appreciation for the clarity of Ms. Fallon's description of what actually is happening there and what needs to be done. It's kind of a complex subject that isn't always easy to understand. So I appreciate that as well. Senator Torres Way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to say something similar to Senator Stumpf. I think that I appreciate what Senator Nino is doing here. I think this is necessary, and this is good practice. I think that if we do screenings, we're going to learn a lot about young children, and it's going to help us really understand how prevention works. So I think that there is going to be, of course, the question as to I think the second part, which, you know, children who are the subject of maltreatment report, which is, you know, a large caseload for a county. However, the screening takes place already, and so the question of costs, we'll see. This is, I think what you're trying to do here is implement good practice through the process. My hope is that we will learn really more about kids and how to intervene early. We know already that we're not investing enough. We know that we don't have good funding for early intervention and prevention. And my sense is that this bill is going to help us understand how to invest those resources better and more efficiently. So I think I think this is a good process to initiate some good practices that could help us understand early what's going on with kids. So I think this is a very good bill, and we'll see what happens with the report for Health and Human Services in terms of the counties.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, I think you've got a couple of other additional testifiers.
Madam Chair, we have a parent that would like to.
All right.
Hi, Madam Chair,
name for the record.
Committee. My name is Heidi Ombisa. I'm here to testify as a parent of a child who is receiving Part C services. I'm also going to speak on my experience. I have a Master of Social Work degree from the University of Minnesota, and I also work in the field of child welfare. So I'm going to try to tie those two pieces together. My son, Kamadi Owen Ombisa, was born...
Can you ever pull the microphone a little closer?
Am I not? Okay. Is that better? Okay. I can't hear any difference, but okay. So my name is Heidi Ombisa, if you didn't catch that part. So my son, Kamadi Owen Ombisa, was born 8 weeks early on October 27th, 2010. He was hospitalized at Children's Hospital for the next 9.5 weeks or so. 6 weeks after his birth, his nurse practitioner discovered that he had a grade 3 bleed in his brain. It's also known as an intraventricular hemorrhage. That IVH caused his brain ventricles to enlarge, and as a result of this diagnosis, his nurse practitioner recommended that we accept a referral to Part C early intervention services so that we could monitor his condition. Of course, I immediately agreed because my son was born so early, and he had a really rough start from the beginning. And I want what's best for my children. So there was no hesitation whether I was going to accept that referral or not. So another thing that I appreciated about that referral was that I would have somebody on board who would be able to monitor his condition and be able to intervene with appropriate services should there be a need. One of the possible outcomes of his IVH is that he would develop cerebral palsy. So what the Part C early intervention services would provide at that point was to monitor any sort of issues that he had that would point that out for us. So, for example, he used to go like this all the time with his thumbs, and that I didn't realize as a parent. I didn't think about that as any issue until they pointed out that that could be a sign for cerebral palsy if we couldn't get him to stretch out his hands. And so our occupational therapist worked with us to massage his thumbs and help him crawl with his hands instead of like this. And as a result, we were able to overcome that one. Currently, he is not at risk of having cerebral palsy, but that's something that we continue to monitor. We also monitor any sort of issues like learning disabilities, hearing or vision problems, that sort of thing. Through Kamadi's occupational therapist, we can target those areas for improvement and work intensively on them. Early intervention also gives me the peace of mind that someone more experienced than I am is monitoring his outcomes. And as I said, should a problem arise, the service coordinator could provide recommendations for additional needed services. So as a parent of a toddler receiving early intervention services, and as a former MSW student who focused on child welfare, and as a current worker in the child welfare field, I strongly support this bill with the amendment. It would ensure that a majority of our vulnerable children in Minnesota would receive the referral to Part C early intervention services. Because poverty is often mistaken for neglect, and families experiencing poverty may slip under the radar of people who would otherwise refer children to Part C early intervention services, I think it's important to have a mechanism in place that would provide this referral to these families. Those families who were reported for child maltreatment and subsequently assigned to the family assessment track may still need early intervention services for their young children. The stress of poverty, combined with a young child with an unknown physical or developmental disability, can cause some parents to cross that line into abuse or neglect. Additionally, besides monitoring young children's physical and developmental progress, early intervention also acts as a support to the parents. I have a great relationship with our occupational therapist, who also serves as our service coordinator, and appreciate the time that she spends coming to our house and working with us and providing us these exercises that we can use for our son. For some parents, this relationship may be the only form of support that they receive while parenting. In sum, I just want to quickly state the importance of intervening when needed in child development. Children who have adverse childhood experiences, as we've learned, such as abuse or neglect, or even children who live in stressful environments, are at greater risk of developmental problems. There is so much research out there that indicates the problems that these children may face later in life as a result of these adverse childhood experiences. And I think it would really be a great disservice for our children to deny them a service that could greatly reduce this risk. And that's all.
Any questions? Senator Nelson?
Madam Chair, Senator Nino, thank you for bringing this forward. I attended this summer, I think, possibly with a few of my colleagues here, a Council of State Government workshop on adverse childhood experiences, particularly from the researchers from the U who studied this and who actually kind of coined that term. And so the data is very clear. And I support the early intervention for all areas, but especially in adverse childhood experiences. My question is there anything that is prohibiting enactment of your language right now? In other words, is there anything that prohibits school districts from providing these services based upon the, I think it was the initial report as opposed to the substantiated report? Is there anything that's prohibiting that right now?
Senator Nino.
Madam Chair, I do know that there are there's at least one representative of a school district that may want to speak to that, that have some various concerns with the bill. Maybe that would be an appropriate topic for them to
Why don't we finish? I think you have one more testifier, that, and we will then ask for others that may want to.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Marcy Jeffries again from the Children's Defense Fund, and I want to thank you again for considering this bill. I think it's a really important step. It updates our early intervention policies to reflect the changes that have been made in the child welfare system. It's important because it translates into policy what we're learning about brain development, as you all have been talking about, and the importance of our first few years to our well-being in adulthood. I think this research is among the most exciting and promising we've had in years because it really points to some ways, pathways forward to improve outcomes for some of the most vulnerable kids and some of the things that we've been concerned about, some of the efforts we've made before that haven't worked as well. We begin to understand that better when we've learned the importance of these first few years and really all that is happening to children and their brains. This bill, I think, increases the collaboration between the child welfare system and the early intervention system, which I think in the end will be more cost-effective. It'll bring more efficiencies into the system. We have also think that there'll be some, and it'll be more cost-effective than our current approach, which is a very siloed two different systems. We think this will increase that collaboration. And we think the savings and the benefit from these early interventions will start showing up pretty rapidly. A study at the University of Minnesota that looked at kids who received, infants and toddlers who received Part C services, by second grade, a third of them did not need special education. That's a huge saving. So it will take probably not too many years for that difference to show up. We also think this is a good time to be updating these statutes because there are some federal regulations that will actually make it easier for school districts to respond to these referrals. So MDE can talk to these more, but they'll be, they won't have to do a full evaluation for every referral that they get. There's some other efficiencies that they can, school districts can do in terms of not repeating and duplicating screening and evaluations that have already been done. And so there are, and there may also be some ways to increase medical assistance reimbursement that some school districts get. So in the context of these other changes and added flexibility that's going to be added in the school district side to respond to these increased referrals. We think that in the end, whatever costs will be offset then shortly by savings in Part C and even by kindergarten, that more kids, a national study found that kids who received Part C by kindergarten, half of them did not need special ed for reading and mathematics. And bottom line, we think obviously increasing these children's well-being will be the benefit of all of us. These are our future workers and teachers and parents, and so if we can intervene early and keep more of them on the right track, we're all better off. So thank you.
You're welcome. Ms. Jeffries, as I've been hearing the testimony, particularly of the parent, it sounds like some of these services actually are more health-related than they are education-related, and it looks like these early interventions involve both. Is it all the responsibility of the education system when we talk about this early intervention, whatever, Part C, you know, we get the lingo here, rather than it being some of that actually being carried by the the Health and Human Services system?
Madam Chair, you're correct. There's Family Home Visiting Services in the Health Department that should be working with these families, with other services, but early intervention in particular focuses on those children who, when they are screened, are already starting to show some impact. So I think the kind of services that Part C delivers, the OT, the PT, the nutrition services, are appropriately aimed at those children and then their families.
But through the school, through special ed, or through a health service?
Well, my understanding Part C does provide is designed to provide OT and PT for early infants and toddlers.
But who is responsible for seeing that they get that?
The local school districts through the...
So it is the school district responsibility. Give us some of it, Bessa?
I just wanted to point out my early intervention provider is through the Mounds View School District. I believe in Minnesota the Department of Education is the primary where the early intervention services are housed in, and it's a collaboration between the Department of Ed and the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services.
So some of the resources for paying for this do come through federal health and human service money?
There's federal Part C money as well that comes down to provide these services.
But it goes to the school? Or
okay. The Part C money does, to the school district.
Okay, thank you. All right. I think we have some others that may be lurking in the wings here to testify. Why don't you come forward? Ms. Gilbert, I'm sorry to accuse you of lurking, but...
I wasn't lurking. I'm going deaf. I was having a hard time hearing, actually. Madam Chair, I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools, but I'm speaking on behalf of the education organization, so you'll only have to hear from one of us. And I did have a chance to talk to Senator Nienau and the Children's Defense Fund folks over the last couple of months, actually, about their proposal. And there's just a couple of concerns that we have. I mean, we are huge advocates of early intervention. You know, in St. Paul, we have 1,000 kids in a 4-year-old kindergarten program, and we have another 800 kids on the waiting list. And those kids are ELL, poor, free and reduced lunch, and special education kids. And so we understand the value greatly. A couple of concerns that we have is that it does increase the number of kids that we will be doing screening in on. And as Senator Nienau said, between 35 and 4,000 students, that is about 500, based on the numbers that we have from the county, that's about 500 additional kids for St. Paul District alone. And to do the pre-K screening, it's often a home visit, you have to bring the right people out there to do the evaluation. It will be more expensive for us to do it. The second issue is that a lot of these kids, as you pointed out, should be, you know, involved in their medical system as well. I mean, the health committee's been talking about families being part of a medical home. A family like this might be receiving some kind of counseling service. They may be getting chemical dependency services. You know, I think that the pediatrician is often in the best position to provide some of the recommendations about what some of the interventions should be. And so I think what we want to ensure is that the medical providers don't get off the hook about providing some of the appropriate health services and end up having the school district responsible. The other thing that happens is that there's a 2-year lag for special education. So if we assume this new obligation, our funding's not going to catch up, or at least it's not going to be put into our base for 2 years. And so I would urge the committee, if they wanted to do this, you know, and it's not a bad idea, that they adjust the school district's base to account for the additional pupils that they're going to be served under the special education system. So they could adequately respond to it, because as you know, you can only spend each dollar one time, and if you spend it on this, then you can't spend it on something else. And we all know that the special education funding is prorated as it is. And you're right, there's nothing that prevents the county from referring for those services right now. And so maybe something that we'd want to consider is there's a lot of really well-trained people dealing in the child protection system, and so that maybe some screening would be done of these kids before they got referred for services. And that way, at least the kids that they felt you know, would reasonably be eligible for the services would be the ones that we would actually be doing the interventions on, rather than just wholesale doing evaluations on every single case that gets referred to us.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Are there any questions? Okay, Mr. Naumann.
Madam Chair, and this is actually a question for Mr. Naumann. So Ms. Gilbert brought up this idea of counting those children into the base. Would that be possible to do some sort of forecast and adjust that? That seemed kind of a difficult task.
Madam Chair, and Senator Bonoff, I think, as I understood what Ms. Gilbert was suggesting, would be an adjustment to the appropriation upwards to reflect the fact that you've got more kids in the system. And that's certainly an option that's available to the committee, because the theory is that more kids in the system, increased proration, more burden on the school district, so they're having to do essentially the old argument of more with less. So I think if you want to say have them do more with a bit more money, that would offset the additional burden that the school districts are having to do. I think if Ms. Gilbert, if I get that wrong, what you were suggesting, please. And Madam Chair, while I have a moment here, I thought I would also throw in that figure of $3,000 has been talked about here, and I'm not suggesting that there isn't an increased burden on the part of the school district, but that's the increased amount of screening. So it doesn't mean that it's the total number of additional kids that are going to be added. Some subset of those would presumably be kids that would be identified for needing special ed services, and that would be an increased cost. But I don't think unless I misunderstand the data and what's been testified to here, I think it's something less than $3,000
or kids.
They were talking 3,000 kids is what I thought I heard.
Well, Madam Chair, a follow-up on that.
Five.
And Mr. Naumann, I thought that we pay based on actual reported number of kids, and so how would that not be captured if the school district, in fact, reported they were serving that amount of kids? Wouldn't their proration be based on number of kids served?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, in special education, we base our appropriation or the allocation based on the percentage of costs reported for all special ed services at a given school district. So if hypothetically the St. Paul School District, because they were testifying, has a higher proportion of those kids, then they may have a higher proportion of the increased burden, if you will, as a result of the additional kids that would enter the system as a result of the legislation before you today.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Is this, Senator Nemo, I don't see an effective date. Do you see this going into effect to this August if it were signed into law, or is there, based on some of the comments that were made in terms of planning for that or the fact that we don't have a funding year until next year, is there any value to considering an effective date that might accommodate some of those concerns?
Well, Madam Chair, certainly that's a possibility, but you're right, the way the bill is drafted, there is no specified effective date, which then defaults to that date. And Madam Chair, I was told that the department is here, and they can lend some clarity to the question you had previously about does this fall under the Department of Human Services or Education, and who's doing what. I'm told that they can give some clarity to that question if you'd like.
Is there someone here that would be willing to address that?
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Karen Cadigan. I'm the Director of the Office of Early Learning at the Department of Education. I'm also a licensed school psychologist, and I worked in early childhood special education, including Part C assessment in Lakeville Public Schools and in Minneapolis Public Schools. And I'm here with a colleague of mine, Kara Temple Hall, just to provide some clarification about the Part C of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And responsibilities and roles therein.
So could you address that, or is it that
yes.
the issue that was raised?
So just sort of in general, the Part C is the part of the federal regulation that covers births to three-year-olds. The process is a bit different than other special education process because of the critical role that families play in the very in the lives of very young children. The plans that that teams come up with are, rather than they're referred to as individual interagency intervention plans. And I'm going to let Kara talk a little bit more about the details of the roles and responsibilities of school districts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Kara Hall. I'm the Part C coordinator for the Minnesota Department of Education. And as Dr. Cadigan said, just to clarify the role of Part C, it is for children and their families from birth to age three. And just to give you a little bit of background on the process, anybody at any time can make a referral for a child where there are developmental concerns. And what that referral looks like is either it can go to the local school district or it can come into the state as a dispatch, if you will, into the Department of Education. And then we pass that referral on to the appropriate school district where that child and family resides. Then the child will go through, if the parent consents to it, the child will go through an evaluation. And that evaluation consists of assessing the child's development over five different domains, and then there's also a family assessment component where the family is given the opportunity to state what their priorities, concerns, wishes, hopes, dreams, outcomes are for their child. And then from that, an individualized family service plan is developed. And the main responsibility for providing those services is the local school district. And with the Part C funds that come from the federal government, those funds are to pay for services for children birth to age three where there is no other funding source that exists. So what that means is through the local school district during the traditional school calendar, they are responsible for funding and providing the services that were mentioned by Ms. Ombisa. And so that could be occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy, early intervention. The focus of the Part C service dollars, like I said before, where no other services exist. So that includes service coordination, which is a mandated service for any child and family who is eligible for Part C. And that person's role is to coordinate not just the services that are provided by the school district within the family's home, but also to look at the larger family needs where maybe those needs can be met through local community partners and not necessarily the school district. It really is by nature an interagency service program, however you want to say it. The other thing that the Part C service dollars are specifically earmarked for are for services provided outside of the traditional school calendar, so during summer breaks. Part C is a year-round service, where Part B, unless you qualify for extended school year services, you just follow the traditional school calendar. So it's during the longer extended breaks, the summer, you know, summer vacation, where those Part C funds are to pay for services as well as evaluation and assessment. And with all of this, the family is an integral part of the planning process, the development, and there are a number of different indicators and measurements that the Department of Education follows and surveys to see how family satisfaction, how that is being rated, as well as the developmental outcomes of the children.
Could you clarify, since with the amendment that went on the bill, it seems to focus on the categorization of the particular case, and it's usually tied to maltreatment. The description of the services and the identification has seem to be presented in much more general terms as this is a service that's available to all children that might have a need or disability, but this particular identification appears to focus on maltreatment. How do you see this functioning, and if it's who is doing the the reporting of that. Do the schools know or have reason to find the early, you know, pre-K or up to age three, that information that about families or what might be happening with the child? Is that where the natural reporting would go, or would it be going to the county?
Madam Chair and Senators, our understanding of this bill and of the addendum are that it provides additional requirements for the child welfare system to make such referrals.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The school districts and the Department of Education do conduct child find activities throughout the state. You may have seen Help Me Grow billboards and on buses as a link to that line that Kara mentioned. Our sort of role, I think, in this piece of legislation is really on the policy implementation side, on wherever you all decide. But the part that we just wanted to make clear is that the referrals have always been, always will be welcome from anyone in a child's life, and that no decisions about eligibility or certainly about what the service would look like, those things never happen automatically, and they always involve parents and, of course, parent consent.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment, and I believe the current requirement, is that it's optional for the screen. What percentage of parents or parent decide not to have a screen? And could you characterize that group in general, and do you think we should make a change on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Weger, I think, and this is not an uncommon thing, that screening, early childhood screening, and special education or Part C referral are often confused. They're not the same. So the early childhood screening program is a universal program where communities reach out to for children in their community to be screened before kindergarten. That's actually quite different from this. This would be a referral to a specialized team that may or may not conduct a full evaluation, but it's I think of it as a stronger connection, I guess, to a team of specialists that may be able to support the family and to support children's development. I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I provide a clarification?
That was Miss. I didn't write your name down. I apologize.
It's Kara Hall.
Kara Temple. Hall.
Kara. Yep. With the Part C services, with the Child Find and public awareness activities that are the responsibility of the system to conduct, without going into detail about the different layers. As it says in the state statute, that the Part C services are to reduce families' need for future services, and especially parents with premature infants or infants with other physical risk factors associated with learning or development complications. Within that kind of child find component is the system to actively seek out, identify, and refer infants and young children with or at risk of disabilities, including a child under the age of three, who, as the legislation states, is involved in a substantiated case of abuse or neglect. So with the child find system and the eligibility criteria for Part C, there is a provision in there for children who have a high probability, who have a condition with a high probability of a developmental delay. So whether it is the adverse childhood experiences that were referenced earlier, or the situation in the family home, that there are risk factors that could, down the road, if these were not addressed early, result in developmental delays that could potentially have been averted had early intervention been provided.
Thank you. Well, I think you've all provided a great deal of information to help us sort out just what role this change in legislation would make, but also a greater understanding of the Part C and what those early services do involve. And I believe this, are you ready to make a motion, Senator Ninawa, but this bill would need to be recommended passed from here and sent to Health and Human Services.
Well, Madam Chair, if we got to go through Health and Human, how about if we make the motion, send it over there, and see what we do from there?
Okay. So Senator Ninawa moves that the Senate File 1165 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Health and Human Services. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is passed and will be on its way. Thank you very much, Senator Nino, and to all of you who have testified. And believe it or not, I think we are finishing before 4:30, our allotted time. Now, I know you are prepared to give us some information on bonding, but can it wait?
Of course, Madam Chair. I sense that we're losing the audience.
By that time, you'll have even more of the bonding for school construction, some of the things that we're facing. Thanks.
Thanks.
Meeting is adjourned.